I might need rescue and recovery before this is over, but not right now. Many thanks to Friends of the Library and their sponsors for continuing this significant experience for the Corvallis community, a series of book reviews that so many of us have enjoyed for so many years. Just think that in 1 month here in this room, we've been able to go from the Nebraska prairie in the 19th century in my Antonia, all the way to a city of 10 million people in China in the year 2010. I just think that's wonderful. We could do that without leaving Corvallis. And thank you, Connie and Deborah, for the publicity, the refreshments. Thank you for the introduction, Connie. When I established my retirement lifestyle a few years ago, I found that I was not spending as much time reading as I really had expected to. I just wasn't giving it a priority that it deserved. And I shared this problem with some of my friends. Some of you are right here. You had the right solution. You just thought if I would read your favorite books, I wouldn't have any problem giving it time for reading. But my friend Connie knew I needed a different kind of reading therapy. I think Connie knew that I needed a deadline and an audience, and I can tell you that will shape your priorities. And what I needed was you. So I thank each of you for being here today. And I need to also thank my husband, Richard, because he accepted a teaching opportunity in China a few years ago, and I got to accompany him in that adventure. If he had truly retired when he retired, then I would never have gone to China, and I wouldn't have the opportunity to be here with you today doing this. I've learned a lot of new things from preparing for this review, some of which I should have remembered. For example, I was reminded that it's important what we bring to a book, that we can meet the author halfway. When Connie asked me to do this review, I quickly read Factory Girls, but I wanted to do some research before I went back to read it more thoroughly. When I came back to read it the second time, the author had so much more to say to me. It reminded me of a statement that John Kenneth Galbraith made once. He was challenged that his writing was too dense. And he said, "Well, I endorse a division of labor between those who read and those who write." And he's correct. I think perhaps it matters less what we choose to read as it does what we're able to bring to the book. The new technologies that are available to us were a great help in preparing for this review. I found on YouTube a presentation by the author at a noon seminar for Google employees, and also an NPR interview with the author that you can download. She has a blog. There is a blog called China Beat that she contributes to, and I've given you those references to these sites on the handout. Facebook allowed me to renew contact with the author's husband, and since then I've enjoyed frequent email interaction with each of them. And through this browsing, I uncovered the event in San Francisco last month that we were able to travel and participate in. Now, I understand that not all of you have read Factory Girls, that some of you come to a book review to see if you're interested in reading the book. So you need a summary. This book would be considered an example of literary nonfiction, which, in our author's words, she describes as using subjective impressions and the techniques of fiction to bring true experiences to life. So, in summary, here's what Factory Girls is about. It captures the everyday lives of the migrant factory population in China with a focus on young women in the city of Dongguan. The author tells the story of these workers primarily through the lives of two young women, Min and Chunming, whom she follows over the course of 3 years as they attempt to create a life that's far removed in every way from their rural villages. As she tracks their lives, a picture of migrant life emerges. It's a world where everyone is under 30. You change jobs and boyfriends, even your name, with as little thought as you might change your hair color. You can lose all contact with friends and family because someone stole your mobile phone. You're promised that a few computer or English classes will catapult you into a whole new social class. To Chang, these girls lived in a perpetual present. They have given up all those Confucian traditions of ancestor worship and filial loyalty, and they live an improvised existence of individualism and obsessive pursuit of a more prosperous future. Interspersed with the narrative of Min and Chong Ming's adventures, Chang takes us into places and experiences that make up the fabric of life for these workers. It's almost like getting two books for the price of one. We tour a sneaker factory that's so large. It has 75,000 workers, and three-fourths of them are teenage girls. Now contemplate for a moment a place where there are 60,000 teenage girls. This factory has its own hospital, its own movie theater, and fire department. Chang takes us with these girls into posh karaoke bars that are really fronts for prostitution. We go to makeshift English classes where students just sit day after day looking at a computer monitor with English words flashing by. We go along on 8-minute dates. One girl says, "You know, usually 8 minutes is too long." Chang accompanies one of the girls to her rural village for the Chinese New Year, and in that description, she reveals the poverty and the forced idleness of rural life that drove these young girls to leave home in the first place. There is yet a third narrative in this book. Chang also weaves in the story of her own family history, going back several generations. I'll have more to say about that later, but I think I could say that three books in one may be too many. One reviewer says that the family history would have made a fine book on its own, and I agree, but I'm not sure I'd be interested in reading it. In reviewing a nonfiction book, there's a tendency to want to discuss the topic rather than the book itself. And as I've asked some of you that I know have read the book for your reaction, your comments tended to be about issues such as a one-child policy or workers' rights, the Google conflict, global recession, the Communist Party. But Factory Girls is not meant to be a guide to current issues in global manufacturing. Chang leaves it up to you, the reader, to draw your own moral conclusions. She offers a human interest perspective because she believes that the newsworthy events of the day will likely turn out to be less important than the transformations in individual lives that are going on beneath the surface. So I will follow her lead, and I'll resist a presentation on current issues in Chinese society, but I've got enough material for a 3-credit-hour course on that, I think. And I will resist making this a story of my life in China, although I might, if I'm on time, sneak in a story or two. I'm going to try to do a book review. First, about the author, and here I'll use her own words from the book. The young women factory workers that I became closest to in Dongguan understood me better than I might have expected. I was born in America of Chinese parents. I had gone to college. Leslie went to Harvard. In education and class, I was a million miles away from them. But I knew what it was like to be alone as a single woman in the city. I was also bullied by Chinese men and yelled at by police and cheated by bus drivers. I also had boyfriend problems. Yes, it was Peter. And parents who worried that I was still single. When I got married in 2006, a friend said, "Your mother must be very happy." Perhaps my strongest link to the girls was one they never knew. I, too, had left home. After college, I moved to Prague, and I worked as a reporter. I lived abroad for 15 years and saw my family once every couple of years, as these migrant workers did. For a long time, I resisted the pull of China. One winter day in Prague, a Chinese couple dragging their suitcases along the slushy sidewalk asked me for directions in Mandarin. I waited a long moment before answering, resentfully in their language, as if they were forcing me back into a world that I had already left behind. But as China's booming economy attracted global attention, my fluency in Chinese became an asset, and I went to Beijing in 1993 to work as a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. I then began to read extensively about China to the exclusion of everything else, because to me, China had always felt like the test that I had neglected to study for. Chang's life among the migrant workers in Dongguan began in February 2004. She spent a week or two there every month during the time that she was researching factory girls. Leslie married Peter Hessler during the time she was She married Peter Hessler during the time that she was researching factory girls. Peter's an American writer who was living in Beijing at the time. He has written several books and frequently publishes in The New Yorker and in National Geographic. His latest book, it was out just this February, is Country Driving. It received a very favorable review in the New York Times last month. It even came up on my computer in the headlines page. Leslie and Peter now live in a small town in southwestern Colorado. Their home is at 8,000 feet. I think that's Peter out in their yard there. They live up there so that he can train at high altitudes for marathon runs. They say that no one in this little town cares about China, that it's good to get far away from what you are writing about. They're expecting identical twin baby girls due this summer. That's quite a statement for that one-child male-favored policy in China. At the event last month in San Francisco, Peter announced that he was not going to change diapers. And he also said that he intended to move the family to the Middle East so they could continue their research and writing from that culture. There may have been some discussion between the two of them since then, because the message I got from Peter yesterday says, "I suspect it may take a while before either of us produces a new book, but it will happen eventually." Let's see, where's Connie? You can turn the projector off, Connie. You know how I don't. To me, the remarkable feature of the book is Chang's ability to maintain a clear focus on the two individuals, Min and Chunming, as well as on the backdrops against which they live their lives. A reviewer says, "She takes the blurred crowd and brings a single human face into fascinating focus." She herself says, "I wanted to illuminate the small thing so as to bring light to the larger scene." I would even say that Chang manages to zoom in through a lens with great depth of field so that she keeps the surroundings in focus as well as the face. And I understand that you maintain a better depth of field, that is, you can focus on the center of interest as well as the surroundings, if you approach your subject. That is, you walk toward the subject rather than using the telephoto lens to zoom in. This is a good description of her work because she actually embedded herself in their surroundings. She says, I tried to fit in as much as I could. I ate 25-cent bowls of noodles. I took buses. I dressed in jeans and sandals. In the rural village she visited, she slept four to a bed, faces next to feet. Now, I have to be honest. Leslie wrote that differently. She said four to a bed, head to foot. The image I have is, you know, like this. So I rewrote it to faces to feet because it has alliteration. I like that. But it's more offensive, don't you think? Faces. Another little aside that I like to share. She said at the event last month that when she told her parents she was majoring in writing at Harvard, her father said, and you think you can make a living just sitting in your room writing? And she thought, well, I hope so. And now, if you think about it, she wrote this book in Colorado, in that lovely location. But I do hope you think and of the work she had to do, the frustrations and discomforts that she experienced as she researched this book. So I would say she has earned the right to sit in her room and write. Her success in depicting the city and the factories, as well as the two girls, allows me to experience an up-close and personal image in the context of the life of these young female factory workers. If there had only been the story of the two individuals, I would have been left wondering if I could generalize from that story to workers in general. Are they representative of the female migrant population? And Chang would say that they are representative in terms of background and the experience of going out from the village. They are typical in that respect. But as individuals, their personalities are not typical. They're more outgoing, they're more adventuresome and independent than a typical worker. It takes some nerve to befriend a foreigner, even one who looks and speaks Chinese. She truly had difficulty establishing and maintaining a relationship with these workers. But the rich descriptions of their surroundings allows us to conclude that their circumstances and experiences accurately represent life for most workers. There are many positive comments in the reviews of Factory Girls. You've seen them on the slides here. There is some criticism, and most of that centers on the attention she gives to her own family history. They challenge her effort to weave it into the report of migrant workers. But even the reviewers who criticize this acknowledge that the family history story is very well written. So how many of you have read the book Factory Girls? Good. And how many of you believe there's a problem in integrating the family history story? About half of the ones that read it. Okay, yeah. Well, Chang herself had a problem adding the family history. So let me read this in her words. Deciding how to write about myself was the biggest challenge of the book. Along with following the lives of several young migrant women, my book also traces my own family's migrations within China and to the West. And that was my plan from the start. But carrying it out was painful. It took two substantial revisions to write myself into my own book. Now, she says she planned to include the family history from the start, but I believe that that's because she understood that she needed to have a personal presence in the book. She had been told this by her book editor and also by Peter, who said after he read the second revision, you write as though you are a frozen observer. As a journalist, she had been forbidden to use the personal pronoun I. She says a journalist has to write as if she does not exist. So her decision to include the family history was an effort to write herself into the book. Back to my camera analogies, it seems to me the personal history story is similar to one of those times when you put your camera on the shelf and you set the timer and then you hurry back to say cheese before the shutter goes off. And when I do that, it seems forced and hurried. I found the digressions to family history interrupts the momentum of the stories of Min and Chongming. Because of their fast-forward existence, it seemed like Chang was taking their picture with a video camera, and she had to put that video on pause while she wrote about her family. I thought I would lose track of these girls, that they'd change boyfriends and change jobs and lose their mobile phone, and we wouldn't know whatever happened to them, while I was reading about Chang's grandfather. But this was part of the problem that Chang had in making the transition from journalism. She has a lot to say about this, so let me share her words. I started writing my book on a March morning in 2006. About 15 minutes into it, panic hit. I am no longer earning a salary just sitting here at my desk. By mid-morning, another realization had set in. I can't go back to being a newspaper reporter. Now, technically, she was on book leave from the Wall Street Journal, so she still had a job. But she could not go back to being a reporter because of the constraints of journalism. They were no longer acceptable to her. Chang says, the opening lines of my book are, when you met a girl from another factory, you quickly took her measure. What year are you? You asked each other, as if speaking not of human beings, but of the makes of cars. How much a month, including room and board? You get overtime? And then you might ask what province she was from, but you never asked her name. As a journalist, I could never have used such an opening, Chang says. I had to have faith that the reader would stick with me to be absorbed in the details of the factory world and the single young woman's story before I stopped to explain, some 10 pages later, the broader context. Newspaper readers have no such patience. They must be told right away that this is a very important story. Her description of the beginning of the book, the 10 pages of personal story, and then some broader view, that reminds me of a technique that filmmakers often use. They begin a movie with a scene that has some emotional content to grab the viewer, and then after a bit, they use what is called an establishing shot. They pull back to depict the setting of the story, and that's what she has done. Now, I have to tell you that I shared some of this review with Leslie Chang, and including what I just told you, and she responded on email just today. She says that she has been thinking of how Factory Girls could be made into a film, and that she also has been thinking of the parallel of the way the book is constructed and the way what filmmakers do. Chang recalls that early in her newspaper career, she argued with a copy editor who had changed a sentence in her story to something she thought was less graceful. "We're not trying to be Emily Dickinson here," he snapped, a remark whose sting lingered with her for years. She says, "I wish I had known then how many others had fought this fight before me." The young Mark Twain was regarded by his editors at the San Francisco Call as incurably literary, and his idiosyncratic writing style eventually got him fired. Ernest Hemingway, a correspondent for the Toronto Star, complained, "This goddamn newspaper stuff is ruining me." But both men became not only great novelists, but also pioneers of literary nonfiction. As a longtime journalist, Chang feels some consolation to see the connections between the reporters they were and the writers they became. When Chang shared that she was a journalist, the reaction of the workers in Dongguan was amusing. People were always disappointed to learn that I was a journalist. With my ability, I was told I could be a highly paid translator at a trading company. English is the path to riches and satisfaction. To them, I was like someone who had won the lottery but never cashed in their ticket. Now, I conclude that her experience as a newspaper reporter gives us a much better book. Her research is thorough and meticulous, and we get the best combination of superb writing and solid documentation. And Chang says, "I don't regret my years as a journalist, I learned how to get information, how to keep asking questions until I understood something, how to cobble together bits and pieces from multiple sources if there is no one deep throat, and there almost never is. So knowing that she herself needed to have a presence in the book, she includes the family history. If this is not adequate, how else is she supposed to expose herself in the book? And I think expose might be exactly what Leslie was facing. She does reveal something of herself in the autobiographical comments that I read earlier. Occasionally, she reveals her own emotional response. You might remember an incident in the book where a bus driver refused to take her to her destination, and she threw something at him as she got off the bus in tears. There are a few cases where you know what she is feeling. I think she's more effective at writing about the other women than she is about herself. When she gives a public reading of the book, she reads extensively from Chung Ming's diary rather than her own writing, although admittedly Chang translated the diary, so I guess that is some of her own writing. Now, I'll show my personal bias in saying that I think her writing is somewhat stilted compared to Peter Hessler's. Perhaps it's because I know him better, but Pete comes alive in his books in a way that Leslie does not. After meeting her, I could say that this reticence, this caution and constraint exhibits exactly the real Leslie Chang. Just this week, I've decided that the real difference between them in writing and in disposition is a sense of humor. Peter loves to write in a way that encourages you to laugh at him. I often read of his experiences and I think, Peter, what were you thinking? Peter, you know better than that. But it's rare to have this reaction when you're reading Factory Girls. There's one scene that comes close. Leslie is in the rural village, and she encounters a woman who has five children. Thinking of the one-child policy, she says to the woman, "How does it happen that you have five children?" And the woman snaps back, "How do you think it happened?" That's one time I thought, yeah, Leslie, you deserved that. But that's the reaction I would have many times through Peter's books. I'd like to share a comment from the visit with Peter last month. He said he intended to be a fiction writer, but when he went to China in the Peace Corps, he found that his experiences were more weird than any fictional story he could have created. And Leslie also says, you should follow where the story takes you, and often that is a more bizarre place than you could ever have imagined. A reviewer says that Chun Ming's life rivals that of any fictional character. Speaking of Chun Ming, I asked Leslie if she could update us on Min and Chun Ming. She says, yes, I'm in touch with both of them. They're doing very well. Min got married and had a baby daughter last year. She and her husband are running a small delivery business near his parents' home village, although I have a feeling they will go back to the city once their child is a bit older. Chun Ming has switched jobs 4 or 5 times since the end of the book. She's now working for yet another direct sales company, peddling French luxury products. If you are seeking a more revealing, more intimate personal portrait, I would recommend a memoir by a factory girl herself. The author is Lijia Zhang. She's written a very engaging book. The title could be a problem for you. I don't think you want to read it in public, at least not away from Corvallis. The title is Socialism is Great. Now, there are quotation marks around the title. It's on your handout, too. Lijia Chang actually led some student protests in support of the Tiananmen Square protests, so that gives you some idea of what message she has in this book. It's a very engaging book. In terms of my camera lens analogy, I think that You might say she uses endoscopy. You might just really find out more than you want to know. I'm going to end my comments about the book so that I have a few minutes to share some China stories. I'm going to read first from the book itself, and then I want to read a poem written by a real factory girl from that book, Socialism is Great. First from Chang, Factory Girls. At night, the factories lining the highways are lit. Look closely and you can sometimes see shadows moving against a window, erratic as fireflies. As long as there is light, people are still working. Each strip of blue lighted windows against the dark signals a single factory. One strip is set apart from the next, like stately ocean liners on the sea. From a distance, they are beautiful. And then this poem. On the assembly line of time, night is nestled with night. We retreat from the assembly line in the factory and file home. Above our heads, an assembly line of stars stretches across the firmament. Beside us, dazed young trees stand in a row. What is strange, though, is that I cannot feel my own existence the way I feel the trees and the stars. Perhaps out of habit, perhaps out of sadness, I no longer have the strength to care about the fixed position I am in. Now, if you will indulge me for just a few more minutes, I'm going to share some comments about some of the issues that are relevant to the book. I wish I had known more about China before I went there. My knowledge was gained rather randomly. Soon after I arrived in Shanghai, I was having lunch with some college girls. It was obvious they were interested in the young men around us. Their conversation was lively. I couldn't understand it, but they translated bits and pieces for me. They explained that they only dated men that had huku. If you've read Factory Girls, you know what huku is. But I didn't. So I asked them if you could tell by looking at a man if he had huku. And they discussed that for a bit, but they told me, no, you couldn't. And one girl told a story that was loosely translated for me like this. She accompanied a man to his room one night. He left his trousers on the chair while he went down the hall to the bathroom. She searched through his trousers. She did not find huku, so she put on her clothes and left. And I thought, well, good, these girls are practicing safe sex. By the end of the day, I had a clear understanding of the importance of the residency certification card that men carry. Huku is the practice in the cities of restricting many places and activities to only residents who carry a card certifying that they have huku, or residency. Each city grants certain privileges to those who are residents, and this means you qualify for housing, or more accurately, to be on a waiting list for housing, and other services such as healthcare, education, entrance to many buildings, and so forth. Now, China has 130 million migrants, the largest migration in human history. According to Huku, you can work in a city, but you can't live there. Think of the problem this creates. Dongguan, the setting for factory girls, is a city the size of Los Angeles in population, and over half of the people there are migrant workers. Now, supposedly employers are expected to provide housing. In the book, the girls start out in dormitories, and then they move out into various other arrangements. Some employers contract with disreputable realtors for some version of worker housing. As a city official told Chang, It would take me 50 years to visit all these factories. They have to police themselves. Now, you can imagine how well that works. One vivid image I have is from the Quanzhou train station, which Chang describes as having a vast concrete plaza. I know that vast concrete plaza. And when I saw it, it's the size of a football field. When I saw it, it was covered with people. May I say it was littered with people and their blankets and thermoses and those ubiquitous plaid plastic tote bags. And my first thought was, oh, no, the trains aren't running. We'll never get out of here. But that wasn't true. And then I asked all these people homeless, and I was told, well, no, they have homes back in their villages. They were what we would call day laborers. The employers had no obligation to provide housing for these short-term workers. And my next question was, where do they go to the bathroom? Do they go to the train station? And I was assured, oh, no, they'd never do that. Now, I, of course, checked the women's restroom, and it was perfectly all right. There weren't very many women, if any, maybe, among the people on the plaza. So I really can't tell you the condition of the men's restroom, and so I still don't know the answer to that question. But Chang had some descriptions in her book that very clearly reminded me of that plaza with so many people living there. Now, my next topic says the one-child policy, and I hardly know where to begin. Nothing I could say that could be generalized over time and place. I guess I'd say whatever you think you know about China's one-child policy would have only limited validity. It kind of reminds me of when I struggled with pronouncing Mandarin words in China. One of my handlers said, oh, don't worry about it. There's probably some place in China where they say it that way. On the other hand, Bill Gates once said to Tom Friedman, you know, Tom, you can be one in a million in China, and there are still 1,300 just like you. So the one-child policy is fascinating. You may not know, over 50 years ago, China forbid the use of contraception or abortion. Needless to say, they had a baby boom that far surpassed ours, which they then had to correct for. And that was the policy that was begun in the 80s, which is best represented as later, longer, and fewer. Later marriage, longer space between children, and therefore fewer children. Now, this policy has never been well enforced. It's been enforced in cities, Shanghai in particular, but not so much in the rural areas. It applies only to the Han Chinese, not to the ethnic minorities. In the rural areas, if your first child is a girl, you could have a second. Now, if they're both girls, then, of course, the parents are concerned that there's no son to move in with a wife and take care of them when they're old. And so that would be one of the primary factors in sending these daughters out to the city, the factory girls, so that they could send money home, and that would be the retirement plan. Leslie Chang wrote an article in National Geographic not long ago about a family that wanted a second child. They had friends that had had two children, and those friends had paid the fine. But these particular parents, in her story, worked for a state-owned enterprise, and if they had had a second child, they would have lost their jobs. Now, the couples in Shanghai who are themselves only children can have a second child. Time magazine says recently that Beijing is rethinking the one-child policy but declares that it won't be changed for at least 10 years. Right now, there are 6 working adults for every retiree, but by the year 2040, there would be only 2 working adults. So I figure that in 10 years, if they change the policy, they then have 20 years to get a working age population built up to take care of the older folks. I'm sure that somebody in Beijing is thinking that through. I'll say one more thing about the one-child policy. one of the books I bought in preparation for this review told me something I had never realized. I knew that they enforced it with fines. I didn't know that they could also try to enforce it with deposits. But this book says that when a couple gets married, among the fees they have to pay is a deposit for a commitment to a one-child family, commitment to defer pregnancy so that after 5 years, if they haven't had a child, they get their deposit back. I guess at some point in life, when the child-rearing days are over, you get your deposit back or whatever. I never heard of that kind of enforcement. It makes me wonder why we don't use something like that when a teenager gets a driver's license. They could make a deposit, and if they haven't had a citation for using their cell phone while driving, you know, in 5 years, they get it back. But I've asked about that policy, and I'm told that the problem is there's so much corruption that those deposits aren't always there when the person comes back to claim them. So that's a problem. Now, this book has an interesting title. The title of this book is Will the Boat Sink the Water? And if anybody can tell me what that means, I'd be glad to give you the book. Will the Boat Sink the Water? And with that, I want to open it up to questions because I'm much more interested in what you have to ask me than what I would have to tell you. Thank you. Connie's going to help me with this.
Other questions or comments?
Yes, go ahead.
Well, recently I read that there are so many more men in China than there are women, that there aren't enough women to marry. Have you read very much about that? And what are they doing to address that problem?
Could you repeat the question?
Yes, I'll repeat the question. And yes, good one. That the ratio of men to women is getting far too high in China. Yes, it's somewhere around 111 to 112, although there are some places in rural villages where they have, by culture, not by dictate, but by culture, had such a predominant of boy births that it's up to like 130 and all. So they have this big problem. And I think it's interesting, the reason why the government now is worried about it is that you have men running around without the stabilizing effect of women, which I'm very glad to hear that there's that concern, and that they seriously are concerned about these young men being more likely to be political protesters. So that is certainly influencing. And actually, as far as government policy goes, there isn't as much of a male favoritism as there is just in the culture. In fact, and there are some places where I saw a sign of a billboard that encouraged families to have children, that girls can also carry on the family history, the billboard said. So yes, they very much aware of that problem.
What's their attitude toward unwed mothers?
I'm going to answer that by saying that the availability and acceptance of abortion tells me that there's still a lot of stigma attached to that.
Sandy, thank you for a wonderful presentation.
Thank you, Ching.
I want to ask you, considering the male to female ratio in China, you would have a lot of young men who, obviously, you mentioned are a potential danger to society and so on. The Chinese army can only employ so many men. What happened to all those men who are out there? Why are they not in factories? Because we often see the typical image of a factory girl making our Nikes and so on. What are the men doing? What are the young men doing? And I could tell you from a perspective in Vietnam.
Please do.
please sit and drink tea.
Tea, okay.
While all the women do the hard work, I mean, even carrying bricks, building houses, doing the rice field, when you go in the city, you see young men sitting around doing nothing. And but it is sad, you know, it's a, we look at them and say, oh my gosh. But then I think it's sad because they are truly without a skill. Because a lot of the factory works require
dexterity. Yes.
And women are much more able to do other things, business and so on. So,
okay.
Is there any hint about the Chinese young men in this book?
Yes. I'm going to start by asking you, if you were an employer and you needed 60,000 people, would you rather they'd be teenage boys or teenage girls? First of all, and dexterity is probably the most concrete reason why the girls are more likely to have jobs in the factories. Another reason is, and this I'm saying this because in her book, Leslie says that the announcements of job openings often said no, only children. So I asked her why the employer is not wanting to hire only children. Now, if you think about the one-child policy, a lot of families had only one child, and it was a boy. They kept trying until they had one. And the reason why the employers don't want to hire only children is they're spoiled. So that they're, by association, it's the boys that are more likely to be spoiled. And typically, it's the second girl in the family. Like a rural family has the first child. If it's a girl, they're entitled to have a second child. Now, if that's a girl, there's a problem. As I said earlier, there's no son to marry and bring home a wife to take care of them. So it's the second girl that is sent out to the factories to work in the cities. And if it had been a boy, there wouldn't have been the second girl to send out.
What do those young men do?
Well, in all fairness, there would be factories in cities that would employ predominantly the males for other tasks. Leslie Chang chose to focus on Dongguan because of the particular nature of the factories there hiring young women. There would be other cities that she could have gone to that would have had a predominance of young males. That do it, Chin? Thank you.
How about on this side?
Can I just add to that? In China, there's a huge labor force in construction, and that would be mostly male. It might be temporary in nature, but that would be some of the migrant males who are uneducated. It's huge.
Did the book go into the conditions in the factory?
Yes, I believe I have an image of those conditions, but I guess I would say, too, not in the sense that so many books about China do. And Leslie Chang and Peter feel very strongly that there are too many books about China that are nothing but victim stories, maybe sensationalized. It's not that they would say that those are misleading. It's just that Factory Girls by Leslie Chang didn't want to make this into that sort of provocative statement. Now, this will the boat sink the water? This is a book of victim stories. And Leslie would say that they lack authenticity. That's why I give the book away. But they're interesting, very interesting.
Is there any kind of hierarchy in the factory that permits shining examples, for instance, to work her way into some kind of supervisory position?
Yes. Repeat. Thank you, Deborah. Yes. Marjorie's question is there some way to be advanced or promoted within the factory? Yes, and that would be a theme in Chun Ming's story of how she wanted to be to promoted and to get a job that would be pay better, be more responsible. I guess my answer to the question is I think so often it's a matter more of some corruption or something that we would not find acceptable as a merit-based promotion scheme, but something else.
Mm-hmm.
But they definitely aspire to having some other responsibilities than assembly line.
Wasn't that sleeping with the boss? One of those sleeping with the boss?
That may vary. That would not surprise me.
That
could perfectly be true. I would not be able to say, yeah, I think I do remember that. Yeah.
What was the question?
Sorry. Is sleeping with the boss one of these routes for advancement? Probably so.
Other questions?
Yes.
Does she overall advocate for us continuing to purchase everything from China and the factories continuing on as they are?
Yes, repeating the question, thank you again. Does the author advocate for globalization, for us to continue to outsource our manufacturing to China? You will not get an answer from her on that. That's just her reticence and caution about such statements. But let me share this. One of the questions that Leslie gets frequently now is, what's the situation in Dongguan as a result of the global recession? And she would say it has bounced back quite nicely. And, of course, the exchange rate is now much more favorable for China than when she wrote the book. So just one of the facts I tried to remember is that she would say that these workers would be, in some cases, glad to start out as little as $50 a month when they went to the factory. But now, given the exchange rate, if nothing else had changed, just the exchange rate, they'd be making about $62 a month. But on top of that, China has increased wages since the beginning of this recession because China wants to shore up domestic consumption to replace some of the drop-off in exports to the U.S. and Europe. And so that, I think that's the way Leslie would answer that question, and she wouldn't take a political position one way or the other.
Thanks, Sandy.